Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
Well, welcome back to the party. If you have not been part of the Delphi Richard Allen saga over the last several years, well, there's a lot to take in. If you're new, there's plenty of time to consume it. We're going to go through where things are at today. Richard Allen's appeal is now fully briefed. 3 judges in Indianapolis are reading the state's response and the defense's reply. And the most striking thing about the state's response isn't what it argues, isn't what it does. The defense raises a van timeline contradicted by FBI cell data, a confession to shooting 2 girls that were killed with a blade, and an alternative suspect whose interview was allegedly recorded over. The state's answer to most of it, which these are rather large things, they don't just seem like it, they actually are. The state says, harmless error, paperwork, waiver, nothing to see here. Move along, everybody. When the prosecution is sitting on a conviction, they have to win on procedure rather than facts. The question then stops being whether Allen got a fair trial and starts being whether the state is even trying to defend the trial that it has. Bob Mata, defense attorney, as always, is with us, who's been with us from the beginning on this case, has educated us on this case 1,000 ways, and the saga just continues. Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, with us as well. Bob? State's response is built on harmless error and waiver, not on actually answering facts that the defense raised. So when you have a conviction in hand and you're fighting back with procedure rather than evidence, what does that tell us about what's going on here?
That the evidence is the worst place for them to fight.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that simple. When they've got that conviction on lock, you know, their playbook is going to be to keep the judge's panel as far away from the trial record as humanly possible. Mm-hmm. Because when you start throwing the waiver thing out there, the harmless error, that's going to require them to get into the weeds a bit, right? They're going to have to get into the record in order to determine, okay, yeah, there was an error here. Gull should have let this in. But the fact of the matter is it's harmless because it wouldn't have changed anything with respect to what the jury ended up doing in terms of coming back with a guilty verdict. So, but the waiver thing's a whole thing. Like that, like when you're reading through that brief, if you haven't read their response brief, just keep that in mind when you're reading it. When you get into kind of every single section that addresses Allen's brief and they start it with waiver, that tells you all you need to know.
Let's talk about the waiver. Help the audience understand what the waiver is and what it means here.
Okay, so waiver is essentially the argument that at trial, that because the defense failed to object to either certain things being introduced into evidence or certain things being said, and if they didn't do that at trial, they didn't renew the objection, okay? Because if you follow Delphi from the beginning, you have a clear understanding that they litigated all this stuff. We litigated, you know, the third party culprit stuff. They did all the motions in limine about trying to get the composite sketch in. All that stuff was litigated pre-trial. What the state is saying, well, that's well and good. But the fact of the matter is that you have to renew that objection at trial. Otherwise, it's waived. And when we use the word waived, that means it goes away and the court, the appellate court, can't address it because it's no longer an issue because it was not properly preserved.
Okay.
Yeah, Bob, the thing that keeps striking me with this, because again, I do not have the massive legal brain that you do on this. I know we as a collective, you probably have seen more that have kind of come to this level of incompetence, but maybe not. How come there's not better checks and balances in here for what looks to be, and again, is this subjectively gross negligence it looks like, or is this really as bad as it looks from the outside as it is on the inside? How come there's not a better lever they can pull on this? Because as I'm looking, again, I can be off on this, but when I'm looking at the probabilities of success of retrial, it's still extremely low, even though it looks so high or am I way off?
No, I mean, if you're looking at it kind of just as a layperson and
like me.
Kind of, no, I mean, look, you're pretty learned in a lot of different ways when it comes to the law, but in terms of kind of like appellate law, it's a different breed. It's different than watching a trial. It's completely, there's different rules. There's different standards. Everything's different right. when you're shifting from trial to the appeals process. So if you're looking at it ostensibly and you're like, wow, man, you know, they really should have objected to this, this, and that, because every old evidence law professor is going to tell you, you know, if you fall asleep at your counsel table, the first thing you do when you wake up is you object, right? I mean, it's a cover your ass type of thing. Ultimately, with respect to the waiver issue, and I don't know if you guys have been able to get to the reply brief, which was recently filed as mm-hmm. well. I think that the defense handled that with great aplomb. So I don't think that that's going to be an issue. I think they're going to have to get to the merits because that's what this boils down to. Are they going to get to the merits of the case? Meaning, are they going to get to the errors that the defense is saying cumulatively all resulted in Richard Allen not getting a fair trial? So, and I think that the defense, in terms of the appellate defense, did an excellent job addressing kind of blow by blow all the different waiver issues that the state put forward. Because, I mean, look at it like this. Like, if you're making a waiver argument, you're telling the appellate court, look, we just saved you a whole bunch of time. You don't even have to get to the issues because you could just say, you know what? Sorry, you didn't preserve it. We don't have to address it. Next, mm-hmm. you know, and just go down the line. And then ultimately, you know, they end up upholding the conviction and then it gets appealed up to the Indiana Supreme Court. So, but I think that the waiver issue, which when you read, you know, the state's response, you're like, wow, man, they just shit the bed. But then when you read the reply brief, what they did is they went into the record and they mm-hmm. showed that there were certainly sidebars that took place where issues were absolutely preserved. And, you know, they make very strong arguments that the law doesn't really support that position, because if we're trying to get to the truth, and I'm talking about the position of waiver, that you don't have to get to the merits, you want in the search for the truth for them to be able to get to the merits and see whether or not the guy got a fair trial. You don't want them taking the easy way out. If they look at it and they say, okay, well, this is the easy way out. This is a hot button case. And, you know, we know that there's a lot of eyes on it and we don't really want to deal with it. We're going to have the conviction stand and we've got the ability to be able to do it through the waiver issues. And the law tends to not really look kindly on that. I mean, the law wants us to get to the issues. So mm-hmm. I think there was enough done in the reply brief. And I'm not going to be surprised if this thing gets upheld by the appellate court. But then I think where they might make their hay is up with the Indiana Supreme Court, especially when it comes to the confession stuff. Right. I think the confession stuff is going to be of great interest to because I mean, it's such a slippery slope, and I know we're going to get to it, so I won't belabor the point now.
I just want to make sure I'm understanding this, you know, the same way that the audience is understanding it. Basically, it's being argued right now from the state's point of like, well, you know, you waived your right to bring these things up. You didn't bring them up effectively or the way you should have procedurally during the trial, and because you didn't do that doesn't mean you can do it now later. The argument from the defense is saying, oh, no, we did. You just didn't register this or accept this the way that you should have for it to be valid. So you saying we didn't do it is not a full truth. It's basically they're arguing schematics to a certain extent right now to say, I want to tell the full story, but are you allowed to tell the full story? Because according to the rules, you kind of did, you kind of didn't. We say you did, we didn't say you did. It's kind of stuck right there at this moment. And the state can still say, well, we didn't follow the rules, or you didn't follow the rules exactly, and we think you're right. So move on, folks. And then that move on might be to the Supreme Court.
Right.
If on the where it's sitting right now, the state doesn't go, okay, let's hear you out. Let's hear some of those oral arguments. Which
yeah.
They might do.
They're going to do it. It's definitely the oral arguments are going to happen.
Okay.
Defense requested it. They're going to grant it. It's definitely going to go to oral arguments. But I mean, when you're talking about oral arguments, you're talking about 15 minutes per mm-hmm. side, basically. You know, it's very limited period of time.
You get a YouTube short to argue your point.
Essentially, that's exactly what it is. Because, and as soon as you're the appellate lawyer and you're kind of getting into your, just as you're getting into your rhythm, they start hammering you with questions. They call it mm-hmm. a hot bench. I love watching appellate cases argued because it's such a back and forth. You know, this mm-hmm. is in a situation where you're going to have a lawyer standing up there yapping for 15 minutes. You're going to get maybe a minute and a half, and then the judges are going to start coming at you with the things that they want addressed. When they read the brief and then the response and then the reply, and they're left with some questions that they want addressed, that's what they start coming at the lawyers with. It's really, if you're interested in the court system in general, I highly recommend that you go and start watching some appellate arguments because they're fascinating. I mean, mm-hmm. it really gets down to the nitty gritty of the law. And, you know, what we're talking about here is just procedural, strictly. Yeah. We're not even getting into the merits of it where you're talking about, you know, what the applicable law is that's come down from the U.S. Supreme Court and what applies. And does this reach the level to where the judges are going to have to say, look, you know, again, cumulatively, Richard Allen didn't get a fair trial. It's like if we're piecemealing everything, maybe one thing on its own didn't amount to that. But when we look at all of it together, it's pretty obvious he didn't get a fair trial. And again, how they're going to address the very complex issue of the confessions yep. is going to be the most fascinating part of it. I think that that's where the oral arguments are really going to live in that particular particular issue. Mm-hmm. Because I think with the third party culprit stuff, you know, they're either going to agree with Gull that there wasn't a nexus, which to me is insane. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't see how that's a thing. And, you know, but the confession thing, because at the end of the day, and we've only heard from one juror, maybe two, so we don't really know what they're hanging their hat on when they decided that Richard Allen was guilty of this. And the one that I read a transcript for was saying that the confessions to her weren't that important. I don't believe that. Yeah. And I think the confession sit as the background to everything else. And, you know, like ultimately at the end of the day, if they're like, oh, well, it was the van thing is what pushed me there. But if the confessions aren't sitting there in the background, if they're not just ruminating in the back of their skulls, it's a different trial. It just is.
Yeah, because once you have that confession out there, then what you have is you have confirmation bias of them trying to prove what they've already come to the conclusion on because they didn't do a deeper dive, understand how that confession came about, what his state of mind was. Yep. And that's where everything lives. Like you said, everything's going to live when they go at those confessions. And I'm curious, Bob, you've been practicing a long time. I can't even probably estimate how many cases you've seen and you've seen appealed. How would you rank this as a just cause for an appeal and out of all the cases you've covered?
I mean, I thought from the get, like my entire coverage, which I think Alice and I were really, you know, and then frankly, Tony, when he'd have me on the show, were the only creators out there that were following this thing throughout the entire pre-trial thing, which is where all the nightmares happen. I mean, I saw it early on that there were going to be legitimate issues, you know, that were going to have to be addressed. And ultimately, you know, the problem, Robin, is that it is really, really, really hard to overturn a conviction in this country. It just is. Yeah. What they do a lot of times is they defend the conviction, the appellate courts, as opposed to kind of looking at it objectively, which is what they're supposed to do. But the way that it typically plays out is they go out of their way. And I'm talking about not Indiana specifically. I'm talking about all appellate courts. They really fight very hard to uphold convictions. And ultimately, it's going to go up again to the Indiana Supreme Court. And I think that the issues are so flagrant in terms of what they did with Richard Allen during his 13 months of incarceration pre-trial that they have to address it. It is not something that can become the norm, because if this thing slips through the cracks and this conviction is upheld and the Indiana Supreme Court says, you know what, we're good with it, and then that it moves into post-conviction act world, post-conviction relief act world, we're talking about a different thing, because that moves it out of the appellate court world. And it creates a very, very slippery slope in terms of what law enforcement and prosecutors' offices are going to say is allowable. Because essentially what they did is they put that guy in a solitary confinement for 13 months until he went mad, you know, and they used that to extract confessions out of him. How it was done, you know, because people are always like, oh, well, you know, he just started confessing. I'm like, all it had to have been is as simple as when he's eating his own feces and smashing his head against the cell walls, and they've cut him off from person to person contact with 100%. The person that matters most to him in the world, which is his wife. All you have to do is say, hey man, you want this shit to end? Just say you did it.
I know. And this is from someone who is already suffering from what we're getting from hearsay anyway. Right. Yeah. And you know, Nelson Mandela said it in his book, The Long Walk to Freedom, because he was incarcerated unjustly in South Africa for so long. He goes, you can judge a country by how it treats its incarcerated. And the fact that Richard Allen wasn't even convicted and he was treated like this while awaiting trial is just the most absurd, abhorrent thing that, again, and it's just like we were saying, it's just one massive data point which inspired confessions, not for his own benefit, but for his family's. And that's just one, plus the police mishandling of shit they kept losing, overwriting. I mean, it's
unbelievable.
And so you're saying that they're defending the process more than the outcome or the evidence or anything else. So they're just bent and determined to defend that the process was correct.
Yes? Yeah. Look, I mean, when I read the reply or the response rather from the state, I don't see them really addressing the issues in a substantive type of way, you know, which is ultimately going to be potentially their downfall, because they didn't address it in the way that they should have, because they're relying on the fact that they waived all these issues. That's not to say that they didn't write some of the brief wasn't dedicated to trying to address the issues, but it's not the kind of legal analysis that you'd want to see if you're rooting for this guy to be remain convicted. You know, it's like you want them defending their position, defending the rulings that were made by the judge and why they were the right rulings, you know, because ultimately I just think that cumulatively that they're going to end up looking at it and saying there's just too much here. There's too much that went on with this particular trial for us to feel confident in the conviction. And in order for them to get there, you know, and I mean, if we really want to get into the weeds, and I don't know if we do or if we don't, you know, when you have the Napoui issue, which we'll probably get to on a different live, maybe as the appellate process moves forward and we get the oral arguments, it would probably be cool to do another live like leading into that, where we can kind of like pinpoint some of the issues. But the Nupui thing is a really interesting one. And that's a structural error. Structural error means we don't need to get to the analysis. You screwed up so massively that everything that that took place after it has been tainted, that there's no way he could have gotten a fair trial because you made this kind of a grievous error up front. And like, I think that that's a very powerful argument, whether or not it's something that the appellate court's going to be able to, you know, sleep at night by just saying, okay, we're giving him a new trial just based on that is where this thing lays, you know? Cause I mean, you're dealing with human beings, you know, you're dealing with,
yeah, with
appellate court judges that are up there, and you know, it's a thing where they've got people in their ears. We don't know what they're seeing or not seeing online. You know, it's one of those things, because you kind of hope that some of the appellate court justices are up there and they're seeing some of the stuff, some of the coverage on this case, you know, even though they have to limit,
yeah,
what their you know, response is going to be to the record. That's not how human beings operate.
When we're talking about this being a human being issue, I want to ask one more question in this segment before we go to the next one, and something we had just talked about. We're talking about the jurors, and very few have come out and said anything from this trial. Very few. A lot of cases, high profile cases like this, you see them kind of scatter out all over and they tell their story. Very few have said jack.
I know
this. Reading the tea leaves, this is just pure conjecture. Bob, when they got off the jury, trial's done, they got a chance to really absorb the information. Hopefully some of them did in its entirety without the filter of gull in between. And they probably saw a case that looked very different than what was presented in that courtroom. That would be my opinion of what any objective person might see when they look at this. Why do you think not many of them are saying anything publicly?
I don't know. I always kind of wonder that when it's a high profile case and you're not hearing from the jurors, and where there's a lot of coverage out there that's really kind of highlighting a lot of the issues that they didn't hear or see at trial, you are left wondering, well, why aren't they coming forward? And, you know, you could obviously make the argument that that's an issue for them that they're not willing to address, because if they ultimately start to feel like they made the wrong decision and they ended up putting this guy in prison for 130 years based on things that they didn't see or hear,
yeah,
it's a hard question to answer.
It's you know a bad what I place mean? To be in. I mean, because I mean, and I'm not trying to shame them. And they don't deserve shame. They did the job based on the information they were given.
Exactly.
And if you're only given a very blinder, half-assed version of the truth, I get how they got to where they got to. But at the same point, you know, it's almost like someone, it's like they've been victimized to a certain extent too. Victims of different crimes and things like that, predatory type behavior. And I almost feel like this is predatory in a way, the way this was presented to a jury, and said, okay, your decision matters. Never mind. We're only going to give you half the truth. And then you're the ones that have to deal with this the rest of your life for making this choice. To me, that is predatory. And shame comes along with that. Not necessarily rightfully so, but shame comes along with that. And I could see a lot of them having shame about it. And also, for their own best interest, I wouldn't want to throw my hat into the ring and have these discussions if I'm right. One of the people who made the decision to put this guy away forever. And now realize, oh, shit, I didn't see all that. It's not their fault they didn't see it. I don't blame them. They didn't get it. But I could see that being like, yeah, I don't want to. I want to pretend this moment never happened to me if
right.
I were them.
Yeah. I mean, because you're sitting there, imagine you're a juror and they're interviewing you and they start throwing all these things at them. And they're like, well, you know, had you heard this, would that have changed your mind? Had you heard this, would that have changed your mind? And you're kind of forced to sit there, because if you talk to jurors in high profile cases that ultimately get flipped on their head somewhere down the road, or something comes out like DNA that is pretty definitive in terms of that this wasn't the person who committed the crime. And then they're forced to kind of address that with themselves.
Yeah.
Because people take that, that civic duty very, very seriously. And the weight of what they're doing in that room, ultimately, when they utter the words guilty or write it down on the verdict slip, they feel that because they understand that they have fundamentally changed just not one person's life forever, but everybody that's involved with that person. Like their lives have been forever changed and altered in the worst way possible. And so for them to find out down the road after the fact, and again, like you said, to no fault of their own, they can't intuit things that weren't addressed at trial, right? And if they were being honest that they didn't know anything about the case or very little about the case coming in, then, you know, I mean, that's a lot to process for a juror, you know, and I get it. Like I probably wouldn't be running if I was in that position. I probably would be keeping quiet myself.
I mean, it's really it's how humans behave. I mean, it's why you have people that still defend predatory churches. It's why you have people that defend all sorts of institutions that, you know, in theory, when operating as, you know, constructed, are not bad things. But when they go off the rails and you still think they're operating as they should be, and you're bamboozled into it, it is good to stand up and say, this is wrong. I was bamboozled here too. And I do see the comment there of like cowardice, self-preservation. These people have lives too. They didn't necessarily say, hey, let me dedicate the rest of my life to Richard Allen's defense. They stood up and said, I'm going to be a juror on this trial, and were essentially bamboozled. So I don't blame them if they don't want to continue down this path and be a spokesperson for Richard Allen. But that is the reality. It's self-preservation. People don't like being wrong at the end of the day. And sometimes the solution to that is not necessarily dive into the pool again to see just how wrong you are. It's been to that pool before. I don't like the water. I'm good.
Yeah, the water was not the right temperature.
And so, Bob, again, I just want to clarify and definitely understand. So, and they were instructed, this is beyond reasonable doubt, correct, that they had to vote that they thought he was guilty.
Yes.
So, and that's where I love giving grace. I am extremely empathetic too, and that's why I think if I was having my conjecture about why we have silence, is because they had to vote beyond reasonable doubt they thought he was guilty. And all you have to do is peek behind the curtain of what is going on outside that courtroom, seeing that there is nothing but reasonable doubt. And so facing the fact that you'll now have to confront people and try to defend how you had that you made your choice beyond a reasonable doubt, it's easily assaulted and hard to defend. So I would say I'd stay silent too.
100%. And the other part of it is, if we take into consideration if they did dive in to all the content online, they quickly realize that there's two warring factions here.
Yeah.
You know, and they're ugly. But, you know, both sides are very ugly on this case. Both sides are adamant about the way that they feel. And, you know, that's a big lever to pull if you're a juror.
Which comes down to the one confession. Seriously, is that where that dividing line is? Because I think everything else submitted was real complete bullshit when it comes to evidence. It really, as I understand it, it really came down to half the world believing that confession that he made, multiple ones, kind of varying a lot on details, and not believing it. Is that really at the crux of what you think that they based it on? Or is there other things like the shell casing that had nothing to do with anything?
Yeah, look, to me,
Or bullet, not casing, right?
Yeah, when I look at this thing, this is what I would classify as a narrative win for the state. Like they won on a narrative, they won on a story. Mm-hmm. You know, and the way that it shook out is that Gull protected that story. Gull didn't allow for the defense to bring in certain evidence that would have made that story questionable.
Doubt.
Because when you've got the story that they have, which is, oh, well, Richard Allen, you know, he admitted he was out to the bridge, and words matter, right? It's like Richard Allen volunteered the fact that he was out there. He didn't admit it, but that's a tricky word, right? Mm-hmm. Because when you say admitted, That's indicia of guilt.
You're like in a dark room. Were you there? Like, no, he actually called and said, "Hey guys, I was there. Can I help you?"
Right. And then
you watch
slip
that first,
into,
if you watch his first interview that he did with the law enforcement guys, that was someone that was completely transparent, truthful, had a cell phone right in front of him. That was not someone covering his story.
I love to hear someone who's skilled in the ways of interrogations who can look at that. And, you know, I'm sure, Robin, when you were first watching those videos, you probably didn't know a shit ton about the case.
No, my you know first, what I mean? You, when I, the first thing I saw really on guys was that interview. I knew about the case. I heard about it briefly. I was going to cover it on Tony's show. And the first thing I looked at was that interview of him with the cops. Yeah. And before I even knew anything else, I said, that's not someone who's guilty.
That's what I'm saying.
Nope.
I don't have nearly the skill set that you do with respect to being able to objectively look at an interview, but I do have the skill set of having dealt with defendants in criminal cases for decades to know what they typically look like when they're guilty and how they respond to questions without even getting into the, you know, kind of the body language aspect of it. I'm just listening to the words.
Yeah, me too. I'm, believe it or not, body language can be extremely deceptive to people. Yeah. And I'm a whole picture kind of guy. Because it's very specific to the individual and you're looking for specificity of, and you're always trying to, and you do it as a lawyer. You're looking, what's the intent? What's the intent of the individual being interviewed and what's the intent of the interviewees?
Right.
You know, and the intent of Richard Allen, when he was in there, his intent was to be transparent. If he was feeling guilty in any way, his intent would not be transparency. It'd be obfuscating. It'd be maneuvering this way. And then when you look at the intent was with his phone calls with his wife, I keep going back to that. His intent was for her, not for self. Not for self-preservation, it's preservation for her. And then you get into the messy crap of the stupid confessions, which if anyone spent even half a quarter of a semester in college looking at social psychology, you'd be like, that is completely BS.
And that's what we're going to be getting into in our next segment.
It's amazing.
It's amazing what you can do when you hold somebody in solitary for 13 months, even when the state has rules saying the limit's 30 days. It's amazing the magic that you can have happen. That's coming up next. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Be sure to weigh in there. The links are in the description.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details. Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.